Can I begin by also acknowledging the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and also to thank my old friend Chicka Madden. We were on the Board of Aboriginal Hostels together many years ago, so it's always good to catch up with Chicka at these Welcomes to Country. Thank you for joining me today in the launch of the Social Justice Report and the Native Title Reports for 2005. Both reports were tabled in the Federal Parliament 6 weeks ago on the 14th of February. The Social Justice Report 2005 evaluates progress after 12 months of the new service delivery arrangements for Indigenous affairs at the federal level. It also sets out a campaign for achieving Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health equity or equality within a generation. The Native Title Report 2005 examines the Australian Government's proposal to engage or to encourage private ownership and leases on communal lands under Indigenous title. Since the reports were tabled in Parliament, they've been widely distributed. About 40,000 copies of the Community Guide to the Reports have been distributed through the two national Indigenous newspapers and other sources. The Community Guides have been launched also at the Parliament Indigenous Village in Darwin, and copies of the guides are outside if you haven't seen them, but they're the very short versions of what's in the report. Because of this distribution, I'm not going to give you a blow-by-blow description of the contents of the reports. Instead, I'm going to talk about what I see are the main challenges in the two reports raised for all of us: Indigenous communities, service organisations, NGOs, and of course, governments. There is a central message that runs through both reports. It is a human rights message, but it would also I'd also contend that it is a common sense and simple policy, and it amounts to simple and good policy. That message is that Indigenous peoples must be able to effectively participate in the decision-making process and any processes that affect our lives. This is not merely an aspiration or something that would be desirable. It is more than this. It is an essential element for the successful participation and the success of Indigenous policy. This requirement for effective participation is strongly supported in international human rights law. It relates variously to the rights of self-determination, non-discrimination, and equality before the law, as well as the right to cultural minorities to enjoy and practice their culture. It is also central for the effective enjoyment of economic, social, and cultural rights, such as the right to the highest attainable standard of health and education. The necessity to ensure that the effective participation of Indigenous peoples also comes from practical experience. Much of the failures of service delivery to Indigenous peoples and communities and the lack of sustainable outcomes is a direct result of the failure to engage appropriately with Indigenous peoples and of the failure to support and build the capacity of Indigenous communities. It is a result of a failure to develop priorities and programs in full participation with Indigenous communities. Put simply, governments risk failure if they develop and implement policies about Indigenous issues without engaging with the intended recipients of those services. Bureaucrats and governments can have the best intentions in the world, but if they have not been subject to the reality test of the life experiences of the local Indigenous people who are the intended beneficiaries of such services, then governments' efforts will fail. More importantly, if bureaucrats or governments believe that their ideas are more important or more relevant than those of the local Indigenous peoples, or that they can replicate policies that have worked in different contexts, such as functional or urbanised communities, or communities which have had have the necessary infrastructure and support mechanism in place, then again, they will fail. These are fairly basic points, but they are of such strategic importance that we need to follow them, and so often they're overlooked. At the international level, principles relating to the effective participation of Indigenous peoples are gaining wide acceptance. United Nations agencies are guided by what is known as Common Understanding of Human Rights-Based Approach to Development Coordination or Cooperation. This integrates policy and programs development for human rights, development, and poverty eradication. It proceeds on the basis that people are the key actors of their own development, rather than simply being passive recipients of services. In other words, governments are there to serve the communities and not the other way around. Specifically, In relation to Indigenous peoples, these requirements for participation have been expressed as the principles of free, prior and informed consent. My office has done some work with the Secretariat of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous issues on this issue when we hosted a workshop in Brisbane in August 2005 titled Engaging the Marginalised. The outcomes of that workshop will be presented to the Permanent Forum in New York in the forthcoming fifth session in May. They are also reflected in both the Social Justice and Native Title reports and form the basis for the analysis of both the Shared Responsibility Agreement making process as well as the debate about leasing options for Indigenous community land. You'll find the full details about free, prior and informed consent principles in both reports. But in brief, free requires no coercion, intimidation or manipulation. Prior requires that consent has been sought sufficiently in advance of any authorisation or commencement of activities and respects time requirements of Indigenous consultation and consensus building processes. Informed requires that information is provided that addresses the purpose, scope, obligation and impact of any proposed activity, and consent requires that consultation be undertaken in good faith on the basis of mutual respect and with full equitable participation. It also requires that Indigenous peoples can participate through their own freely chosen representative and customary or other institutions, and ultimately it must allow the opinions of Indigenous peoples to withhold their consent. The principle of free, prior and informed consent has recently received important international endorsement by the United Nations General Assembly. In adopting the Program for Action for the second international decade of the world's Indigenous peoples, five key objectives were agreed to in the debate. They included promoting the full and effective participation of Indigenous people in decisions which directly or indirectly affect them, and to do so in accordance with the principles of free, prior and informed consent. Relevant to the new arrangements, the objectives also include adopting targets, including concrete benchmarks for improving the situation of Indigenous peoples, and developing strong monitoring mechanisms and enhancing accountability frameworks for the protection of Indigenous peoples. They are the challenges that exist for governments in Australia today. What the two reports being launched today show is that there are some good instances where government are beginning to address these challenges. The commitments and the right words are there in policy, but there are also many instances where the challenges are not being met. We have a long way to go for the rhetoric of government to be matched by actions. Crucially, this action must be principled. That is, it must be based on acceptance of the central importance of Indigenous participation. At this stage, I cannot describe the new arrangements as being a partnership with Indigenous peoples without which proceed on this principle based on a consistent level. This is not to say good things are not happening, for they are, but it is important for governments to walk with Indigenous peoples and not to run ahead and expect us to catch up. This social justice report and its predecessors have provided a thorough overview of the new federal service delivery arrangements and have identified the challenges to ensure the process of participation and inclusiveness of Indigenous peoples. I've received a lot of feedback that the reports provide an excellent documentation of what the new arrangements actually are and that it is being used by a number of people, and particularly people in the public service, as the Bible, which is interesting. This is good, but it also reflects that one of the most basic problems of the new arrangements is the lack of information delivered down to the local level for both bureaucrats and bureaucrats who are implementing the new arrangements, and more crucially, for communities. There remains a basic information gap, information that is culturally appropriate and in a language and delivery format that Indigenous people can relate to is critical if we are to achieve engagement with Indigenous peoples and ultimately sustainable outcomes. This is the informed consent of free, prior and informed consent. The social justice report focuses on four sets of issues relating to the new arrangements. They are how it enables Indigenous representation at all levels of decision making, how it supports Indigenous participation through engagement making processes, or arrangement-making processes, which include when it is appropriate to negotiate service delivery on the basis of mutual obligation principles, ensuring clear processes for government engagement with Indigenous peoples, and there exist clear mechanisms for accountability and transparency of the new processes. My conclusions on these issues may surprise some people. In particular, I find that if done properly, shared responsibility agreements can provide a useful tool for realising the human rights of Indigenous peoples. When I say properly done, I mean that the process through which the arrangements are struck is on the basis of free, prior and informed consent, and that it is supportive of Indigenous communities and builds their capacity to engage with government. For agreements to be properly done, they must also not make the delivery of basic human rights subject to conditions, nor impose conditions on Indigenous peoples that are not applied to other citizens. The report challenges governments to build human rights standards into the processes of the shared responsibility agreements. But there is also a challenge for Indigenous communities. SRAs are an opportunity for you to realise community goals that you may otherwise have not been able to achieve. The relationship with government that they create is also an opportunity to simplify lines of accountability to government. I say this as the government has often stated that a goal of the new arrangements or the new processes is to move to longer term funding cycles with single agreements rather than the multitude of funding agreements and arrangements that currently exist in communities. And comprehensive SRAs are likely to provide a mechanism for this to be achieved. The challenge is for Indigenous communities to seize the commitments of government and to make them work for us. Turn it into your process. The government should be reactive to your priorities and not the other way around. And we've heard the Prime Minister and previously Minister Vanstone make those very clear statements at the last year's National Reconciliation Workshop that they wanted to listen to Indigenous people, and we're going to try and hold them accountable to that. What I provide in the report as well, however, is information to ensure that you are not coerced into the process and so you can understand what your basic rights are in the process. And this is a challenge for service delivery organisations, the NGO sector and HERIOC. We need to provide support to communities so that we can effectively advocate for their rights and they can effectively advocate for their rights in this process. I've indicated in the report that the major focus of my office for the next report is to be monitoring these arrangements and the process by which they are struck, so we can learn from those communities who have succeeded. And you'd be surprised, while there appears to be a general ban on national newspapers on success stories, I can assure you that they exist, and some of them exist. Some of those positive good news stories do exist through some of the SRAs. There is one other issue that I want to raise in relation to the new arrangements. It is about Indigenous participation and representative structures. The first part of the report documents the process that exists for Indigenous participation in the new arrangements. We are now coming close to 2 years down the track of the new arrangements, and there exist limited mechanisms for representative engagement of Indigenous peoples. And this is at the international, national, state and regional level. This is a serious problem. The absence of a framework for Indigenous representation at all levels of decision making undermines and contradicts the aims of the new arrangements. The report recommends that the federal government, in participation and partnership with state and territory governments, prioritise the negotiation of regional representative arrangements with Indigenous peoples. And representative bodies should be finalised and operational by the 30th of June 2006 in all ICC areas. And considering that we're 2 years down the track, there's no excuse. And considering that Amanda Vanstone announced that they were well and truly on the way after the Ngarrindjeri agreement was signed off, then there's no excuse. And so that's my challenge to government on this issue. But there's also a challenge to Indigenous peoples and communities. Representative structures can only work if they are in fact representative of the community. They must be owned by the community. They cannot be developed by government. The challenge for communities is to clearly elaborate regional structures that they want and how they think they'll work. And many structures have been proposed already, but not in all regions of Australia. In saying this, I'm not letting government off the hook. I believe that the federal government in particular has been passive, it's a good term they like to use too, passive in this issue. They have too easily sat back and thrust responsibility for getting regional bodies in place on Indigenous communities. There are capacity issues with this, and there are also trust issues. We should remember that the abolition of ATSIC is very recent and it remains hurtful for many Indigenous people. And so people aren't going to just run into new arrangements. To me, the problem of the absence of process for thorough Indigenous engagement and participation is shown by the debate on land reform and land tenure arrangements on Indigenous communal land. And this was the focus of the Native Title Report. We've seen a debate about an issue of critical importance to Indigenous peoples, creating wealth and sustainable economic development and the role of Indigenous communal lands in achieving this. But this debate has happened without an eye to history and without applying the reality test on Indigenous community lands. And you remember I talked about that reality test and that's testing it with Indigenous people. We need to exercise great caution to ensure that options for individual leasing do not result in the very opposite to what the policy debate seeks to achieve. It is possible that leasing could lead to entrenched poverty traps for Indigenous peoples by creating unsustainable debt levels, with the outcome that communal land is compromised or lost. This was the experience overseas in the United States, Canada and New Zealand, and it was a policy failure by the World Bank in the 1970s. The Native Title Report sets out challenges for governments in processing the individual leasing proposal and in promoting economic development for Indigenous peoples. The first and most basic is ensuring that Indigenous peoples are able to provide their free, prior and informed consent to any leasing proposal. This includes full information of the likely impacts, including the obligations of being a homeowner, maintenance issues, finance issues and so on. Leasing may work for some individuals and some communities, but is a high-risk strategy that it needs to be acknowledged and it needs to be addressed before it's put into place. Other challenges include: we build on existing successes using examples of Indigenous business development and use these models for other business development processes, the building blocks strategy. Government commits to develop infrastructure to support business enterprises and service provision on Indigenous lands, and we focus on issues of financial literacy amongst Indigenous communities, particularly in remote communities. To conclude, I want to return to the Social Justice Report. When I talk of challenges, and there is another major challenge that is laid out in the report, it is a challenge to all Australian governments to commit to achieving Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health equality within a generation. You'll hear more about this proposal during the next 12 months. I've met with numerous organisations in the Indigenous health, general health and NGO sector about this commitment. It has received enthusiastic and unanimous support from bodies as diverse as the Australian Medical Association, Australian Division of General Practice, the Royal College of Physicians, through to the National Aboriginal and Community Controlled Health Organisations and all the medical services under NACHO, and as well as ANTAR, Oxfam, the Ian Thorpe Foundation for Youth, Fred Hollows Foundation, and numerous other groups, including the Australian Indigenous Doctors Association, whom Romley represents. Ultimately, achieving equality for Indigenous peoples in life expectation rates within 25 years is an achievable goal. If we are a nation that believes in fairness and dignity for all, then we will not hesitate to commit to this goal and do so in a specific, targeted way. That is what has been missing. There are many great successes in Indigenous health and some of the world's best frameworks and reporting indicators for measuring it, but we have not committed to a holistic and targeted way for this to happen. Indigenous health equality will not happen without deliberate, targeted steps. We know this. The last 20 years of action proves this. The report sets out sub-targets of ensuring equal access to primary health care and health infrastructure within 10 years. It also challenges government to incorporate health perspectives into the whole of government arrangements and approaches that they're currently adopting. In my view, we have in place the building blocks to achieve health equality. We have a unique opportunity to achieve this, and we must grab it. There was an interesting forum held earlier this year called the Australian Futures Directions Forum. About 100 people aged up to 40 were chosen on the basis of their likely leadership role in Australia within the next 20 years, and they were asked to set out a blueprint for Australia's future. I want to read to you a statement that they endorsed about Indigenous health and disadvantage generally. It is a very striking and inspiring. It reads, "We declare that the ending of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples' disadvantage is the number one priority for the 2006 Australian Future Directions Forum. We stand diminished as a nation unless we act immediately and decisively to address the marginalisation of Indigenous people across all areas of life. This is not only desirable, it is achievable. It would be outrageous for this level of alienation and disparity to continue into the next decade. As future leaders, we are determined to take all efforts to address this legacy. We do this because it is right. The manifest disadvantage of Indigenous peoples is intolerable. By doing nothing, we stand to witness the irreversible loss of the most ancient culture in the world. There have been considerable detailed works done on the solution to Indigenous disadvantage and for the recognition of Indigenous cultures, so we can all be confident that, with refinement, the elements of success exist. The focus then must be on commitment, priority, and action. This is a challenge for all Australians. It's not only up to government. And I commend those people and those 100-odd people that were at that forum because, it's a great statement. So let me give you an example. In recent years with the Australian Division of General Practitioners, in a recent meeting with the Australian Division of General Practitioners, the CEO asked me the following question. She said, "When the tsunami wreaked its terrible damage across Asia, there are about 4,000 health professionals who pledged their support and volunteered their time. Yet there is perhaps 4 people who have volunteered their time to work with Indigenous communities who are experiencing conditions which are equally severe." And her question was, why? Governments need to be accountable for the achievement of health outcomes to Indigenous people. At present, they are not sufficiently so. But there is also a role for NGOs, for the medical profession, for the sports sector, for business, philanthropists, and the general community. Throughout the year, I'll be calling on all sectors of Australian society to express their support for commitments to achieving Indigenous health equality within a generation. The challenge is set out in the Social Justice Report, and I commend it to you. So to conclude, my intention today is to challenge you and to inspire you. We're all working for the same thing: equality, dignity, and for Indigenous people to enjoy everything that the rest of Australian society takes for granted. We can achieve this, and we will continue to challenge all of you, and particularly governments, as we move down that road. Thank you.